You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. Well, as you've probably noticed from the graphics advertising this episode of Monster Attack, we are revisiting once again another film that I had talked about earlier in the history of Monster Attack. This one called The Neanderthal Man from 1953. And it's one that's of special interest to me because of something we just talked about last week on The Adventures of Superman. And I'm going to get to all the tie-ins here in just a minute. But I want to tell you just a little bit about, we talked about the Neanderthal Man in season number 2. Monster Attack was still a relatively new podcast. I was still finding my wings. We did a lot of experimental things here and there. And I remember doing the episode. I don't really remember what all I said about Neanderthal Man, except probably who was in it, who directed it, and a little bit about seeing it as a kid. But I wanted to revisit this one, and a lot of folks might be saying, why the Neanderthal Man? This has been sort of always billed as a really, really stinker of a movie. Well, it probably in the minds of a lot of people is a stinker of a movie, but it's one of those that, as a kid, I absolutely fell in love with. And it played quite a bit on Monster Movie Matinee. And for some reason, I grew just an absolute affinity for this film. And it was very hard to see. After I got into high school and college, again, the number of shows that did sort of monster movies shrunk down a little bit as we got into the late 70s and the early 80s. There were a couple of very famous shows, Elvira and some of the others, but not as many as when we were growing up in the 60s, where it seemed like every local television station had a monster movie show or even more than one monster movie show. And Neanderthal Man was hard to find. Now, I was able to get a copy of this on VHS tape in my early collection that you've heard me talk about many, many times, was destroyed 11 years ago in a tornado. This film became a very hard one to find. It was very, very hard to find on streaming. Just about a year ago, I thought, maybe we'll revisit The Neanderthal Man and I can see a good digital copy of it on a streaming service. And at the time, nobody had it. It amazed me how hard it was to find until just a few months ago when it showed up on YouTube. And I have the YouTube app on my one of my streaming apps, and I just happened to find it there. And it's a pretty good restored copy, restored exactly as it would have appeared in movie theaters. So the right ratio and all that, the 4:3 ratio. And it had been cleaned up quite a bit. And it was then that I realized, just watching it the other night, after finally finding it and looking for it, yeah, wow, it's pretty cheesy. It surely is. But there's a reason I wanted to talk about it on this week's episode specifically. Some of it was triggered by last week's episode where we talked about The Adventures of Superman. And anyone who knows me knows how much of an impact that show had on me. Of course, I talked about it quite a bit last week. But one particular person that appeared on The Adventures of Superman, Robert Shane, the old character actor who started out as a very successful stage actor in the 1930s and 40s. And then he tried his luck at films and did a little film work in New York where he was discovered by Warner Brothers. They signed him to a contract and he went to Hollywood. And he wasn't really satisfied with the way that went. I mean, normally as an actor, you get pretty excited when a big studio signs you to a long-term contract. they put them in a series of B-Westerns, and some of these, what they call two real Westerns. They, you know, they're like shorter films, an hour long. They would usually be the preliminary film to lead into the big main event film that you would see in movie theaters back then. And then later he was able to work himself up to some supporting roles in A films, but he got sort of disillusioned with what Warner Brothers was doing with him. So he thought he would try his hand freelancing. And that's when he ended up going out on his own, and he made quite a few science fiction films and monster movies. Of course, those of us who were monster kids loved him in the films that he did. He was in Invaders from Mars, Kronos, The Giant Claw. I remember The Giant Claw. He was one of the Air Force guys in that How to Make a Monster, which, let's see, I think we talked about three seasons ago, War of the Satellites, the second monster movie I ever saw in my entire life, and The Indestructible Man, which he had basically a co-starring role in before he got his starring role in the movie we're talking about this week, The Neanderthal Man. Now, unfortunately, this might not have been the legacy he had planned on leaving for himself, but at the same time that he got the gig shooting The Neanderthal Man, he was cast in a television show. Yes, The Adventures of Superman. And Robert Chane became known to my generation and people my age as Inspector Henderson on The Adventures of Superman. And so we started looking for any movie that he would show up in. He ended his career with a television appearance at the age of 90, 1 year before he died, on the television show The Flash, not the one that's currently playing on the CW. This was the one that played on ABC in the 1990s. And he played a blind newsstand owner. There we go. I'm tripping all over my words today, folks. Sorry about that. And he was actually at the time legally blind. So, you know, he was able to pull off his own personal experiences to bring that into the character. I always liked his voice. He had a great radio voice. I could see how he did very well on stage because he sounded like he had been classically trained. I mean, he had very good diction and delivery and was very believable in the roles that he played. Now, in the film we're going to be talking about today, he really chews up the scenery. And some of that may have to do with the director of The Neanderthal Man. I'm going to put some of that in his lap, Ewald André DuPont. Hope I got your name right, sir. DuPont was considered one of the principal characters in developing German cinema back in the early part of the 20th century. He became a very successful director in 1917, did several successful silent films, and was known for being one of the leading directors of German Expressionism. But when he continued his career in the sound, in the sound generation, I should say, after 1927, things didn't go well for him. And he had a couple of major failures as films. And, of course, you know, this business is a very, very conservative business. So Ewald found himself not getting too many jobs and ended up making basically a lot of directing jobs of very little-known films like this one. This was one of the last films that that he was a director on. I think he would go on to direct only three or four more times, and most of that were television episodes. So The Neanderthal Man was basically the next to the last feature film that he was involved with. He did do one more, also in 1953, called The Steel Lady, which I confess I don't know much about. I think that maybe his experience in German Expressionism and maybe as a silent film director may have caused him to maybe have his characters over-emote a little bit. This is just a theory. Cannot prove that. But yeah, Robert Chane I'm trying to be very kind because I really am a big fan of Robert Chane. Really, really had to chew the scenery in this one. Playing, I guess you would call him our mad scientist role. He's a professor who is an expert on prehistoric man, and he's got a theory, sort of a crazy theory, in the eyes of his peers, that Neanderthal man was actually more intelligent than modern-day man. And his theory involves studying the size of the skulls of primitive man and comparing them with the size of the skulls of modern man and the size of their brains. And that we have a scene early on in the film where he's making a lecture to a scientific association, pitching his theory that the brains of the brain of the Neanderthal man was larger than the brain of contemporary man, which led him to believe they were more intelligent. Now, it's interesting. He also mentions in his little treatise, The Piltdown Man. And some of you who have not seen this film and may go out and see this after I do this episode will say, Piltdown Man, I don't recall that. That actually, interesting, at the time the film was written and shot, was a controversial theory concerning another type of primitive man similar to the Neanderthal man, but different from Homo sapiens and Homo erectus. And later that was proven to be a fraud, a total fraud. There were the skulls and the bones that supposedly were from Piltdown Man were a total fabrication. And the ironically, the theory of Piltdown Man was disproved just before this film was released. But at the time, it was sort of a somewhat considered a scientific theory. But Shane's character in the film, Clifford Groves, is laughed out of the scientific association, and he is now bound and determined to prove his theory is true, and make a mockery of those who mocked him. So here we've got our mad scientist at work here, and what he is doing is he has a theory that is one that has been used quite a bit in science fiction films, and that is that within each person, our entire history is somewhere within ourselves. Now, in the 50s, you know, this is still pre-DNA as far as, you know, much knowledge about DNA or that sort of thing. But I would say that, you know, nowadays when I have seen some uses of that story venue, they sort of imply that within our DNA is sort of a record of every type of man that we were, all the way from prehistoric up to modern day man. And his research in this movie involves him trying to tap into that. If he can create a Neanderthal man to prove his point, then, you know, there we go. Now he can take that back to the scientists and say, hey, see, I was right all along. Well, as crazy as that storyline sounds, I watched this as a young kid. You know, I was like in the second or third grade. I loved this stuff. So I ate it up. Now, as I got older, and especially when I watched this just recently, a couple of weeks ago, it was like, oh, wow, yeah, that was a real stretch. I don't remember what I thought about it 4 years ago when I did the episode in the second season. I guess maybe, well, I was tempted to go back and listen to it. And then I said, no, I want to do this. I want to do this episode without being influenced by that first one. So yeah, it comes off as a little goofy. So we will talk about the other cast of characters as we go along in the storyline here, because you're going to see a lot of familiar faces from 50s and 60s television. And one lady who makes her feature film debut in The Neanderthal Man, and that's Beverly Garland, who was no stranger to films from AIP and others. She plays a waitress in this. Everything takes place up in the mountains of Northern California. And Dr. Groves, or I'm going to call him Dr. Professor Groves, he has a cabin up there that he is renting out in the middle of nowhere, and he made a little lab in there. That's where he's doing all of his experiments so that he can be, you know, have peace and quiet, and no one's going to be looking over his shoulder. And it's just he and his daughter are living up there, yeah, so that he can do things on his terms, so to speak. His daughter, Jan, is played by an actress by the name of Joyce Terry. And Joyce, you know, was an actress and a model, might be recognizable to you. She only did 10 films during her career. It was a very short career that ended in 1960. But she you know, got out of the business and was married to Paul Frees, who's a very famous actor from this time period, and one that we followed in a lot of. He was in a lot of science fiction films and had a very, very, you know, very, very recognizable voice. And Joyce was just satisfying being the wife of Paul Frees and living a normal life and you know, giving up the whole world of acting 7 years after she did this. But, you know, very pretty gal. You could tell she was probably had a contract with the studio at some point. She received, it's interesting when you look at actors and actresses from the 50s and the 40s when they were contract players, and which means they would usually receive some kind of training and instruction as well. They all had similar types of delivery. You could tell that they were trained by the same methods, and the women especially were very similar in the way that the characters that they played and how they sounded and how they delivered their lines and things. And Joyce was one that you might say, yeah, man, I should remember her. And that's because she probably reminds you of a lot of other actresses from this time period that played in B-movies and sci-fis and monster movies and such. But they have a pretty good chemistry together. The thing that I remembered as a kid was, you know, I really liked the character of Inspector Henderson in The Adventures of Superman. But the character of Professor Clifford Groves in The Neanderthal Man is not a very likable guy. Although you want to like him because you like Robert Chain. But yeah, he is a total obsessed professor who is going to prove his point. And Robert really plays this up. I mean, he plays this big. Right in the very beginning, we see his character sitting in his laboratory, and he leaves and he goes into another room of the cabin, and he hears this crash and goes running into his lab and sees a cage that is all in splinters on the floor, and he looks up and the window is smashed out, and we have heard this huge roar, like an animal roar, and his eyes just bug out of his head. You know, all of that, and you go, oh boy, yeah, this is gonna be some scenery chewing coming up. And unfortunately, he plays that. You know, he plays it almost psychotically, and I think that he was directed that way. I think that's exactly what DuPont wanted him to play. Little bit over the top, and I think it's probably one of the reasons this film got panned so badly by the critics when it came out. I mean, you know, a couple things going on here. Is it the best written film I've ever seen? No, not at all. I mean, it's a low budget film. It's a little goofy in its storyline, and it makes a lot of mistakes along the way. There's a lot of problems with the logic flaws and stuff, but it's a fun, entertaining film. This is one, folks, I'm going to ask you. You're just going to have to just suspend all kinds of filters on this one and just have fun with it. And this would be a good Mystery Science Theater 3000 night where you have a bunch of friends and you could just enjoy the film for what it is. It wasn't meant to be a work of art. it's just a fun way to spend about an hour and a half. And for some reason, and I, to this day, still am mystified as to why this film had such a hold on me. But I have a theory, and I'm going to get to that. I'm going to be all over the map on this episode, folks. I'm sorry. You know, and we will talk some more about this movie in just a second. But if you remember last week, during the episode on The Adventures of Superman, how I talked about my mom was really good at making costumes. And she was. She's just really great. And, of course, one of my all-time favorite Halloween costumes that she made for me was a Superman suit. And I was somewhere around the second, third, or fourth grade. I can't remember precisely. I think it was fourth grade, but I really don't remember the exact year that I had the Superman suit. But around that same time, I saw this movie, The Neanderthal Man, and it really grabbed me. I really liked the monster in this because Robert Chain's character, yes, spoiler alert, we're going to spoil everything on this. He turns into the Neanderthal Man. I mean, you could probably sort of see that coming. And another movie came out 5 years later, 1958, which played very close. The same time that I saw this one, I saw Neanderthal Man first, but then I saw Monster on the Campus. Now, that's also a film that we discussed in the second season of Monster Attack. And it was another favorite of mine, where a scientist is doing prehistoric studies and he accidentally gets exposed to some blood from prehistoric days, and it sort of turns him into a Neanderthal type man. And that film I loved a lot as well. It was done a little bit better than this one. The storyline was a little more interesting and a little more believable, but it was goofy in its own right. If you were to compare the two, I'd have to say Monster on the Campus was a little bit better than Neanderthal Man. But I was so influenced by those two monster movies. And, of course, Mom many times watched the movies with us. And when Dad was home off the road, he always watched them with us. So she knew how much I really liked The Neanderthal Man and Monster on the Campus. Now, the makeup for both monsters was a little different. And the Monster on the Campus makeup was probably a little better than the Neanderthal Man makeup. The hair that they used for the Neanderthal Man, and it was clearly a rubber mask on an actor. It wasn't on Robert Chain. They brought in a stuntman because he had to do some – the physicality of the role required them to bring in a stuntman. But, it didn't lend itself to facial expressions and things of that nature, like some of the terrific makeup we saw in Planet of the Apes and that sort of thing. And the makeup in Monster on the Campus did a little bit. It gave, the performer a little bit more control over his facial expression. So that was one bad thing about the budget being so low on the Neanderthal Man. But what Mom did, I'm really going roundabout in this story here, was she did a combination of the two characters, of the two monsters, and made me a Halloween costume based on both of those. And we just called it, my Neanderthal Man costume. And she did such a terrific job on it. And the facial makeup she did for it was just incredible. Absolutely. Now, some of it did involve a rubber mask, but she found a rubber mask that would work. And then she adapted it and then put hair and stuff on it to make it look almost exactly like a combination of the two makeups that we see in those two films, in The Neanderthal Man and Monster on the Campus. I was a Cub Scout at this point in my life, and we were having a Halloween party, and we were going to have a costume contest. It was a costume party, and I wore my Neanderthal Man costume to the party, and I won first place. And I'll never forget a friend of mine. His father was helping out with our party, and would help out with the Cub Scout pack from time to time. And when he announced, and he said, "And our winner is," and he goes, "I'm not really sure what this is, but he's the winner." I had to correct him and say, "I'm the Neanderthal Man." So, so people didn't really know what it was, but they just thought it looked pretty cool. So. What I'm getting at is I'm recording this show just before Mother's Day. And after, it sunk in about the Adventures of Superman episode, I got, that was really a fun episode for me to do because that show was so much fun for me to watch and still is. I still watch it all the time. I got thinking, and then Mother's Day coming up. And, of course, my mom passed away a couple of years ago, as many of you know, because I remember we dedicated an episode to her right after she passed away. And they got me thinking. So, it's near Mother's Day, and I'm thinking about Mom. And we're coming up on the second anniversary of her passing. And I thought, Mom, this one's going to be for you. Because I'll never forget these costumes that you made for me for Halloween. So last week we talked about you for The Adventures of Superman. This week I got thinking, this is the show I'm going to do this week. I'm going to talk about The Neanderthal Man, and mentioned that costume that you made for me way back when. I mean, so many years, not quite 60 years ago, but close to it. So this one's for you, Mom. And I think that is probably something that has always endeared me to this movie as well, because I keep remembering, the emotions that I get from this movie, are reminiscent of the great time I had. This was such a fantastic time in my life. I had just discovered monster movies a couple of years before this. And you know, was building models right and left. Every time I finished a model, I would save up 99 cents and get another one and build all the Aurora models. And I know there's people out there that know exactly what I'm talking about because they write us letters all the time, emails to us all the time, send us pictures of their models. And if you'll join the classic Movie Monsters Facebook page that Monster Attack operates, you'll have a chance to see some of those people, you know, post their pictures of their monster models in that one, because it was just such a phenomenal time in our lives. So I think all of that came together to bring about, hey, let's revisit Neanderthal Man in a little bit different context. So now let's get on with the movie. If you're not familiar with this film, You've got the professor, you know. Now something has escaped from his lab. Oh my God, what is it? It sounded like a lion or something. And of course, we've got a situation where it is. It's a saber-toothed tiger. Now it's funny. As a kid, this was the one thing that I'll never forget when I saw this. The saber-toothed tiger they had in the movie was an actual tiger. They used a real tiger, and then they just, you know, put fake tusks on it or whatever. And they were using some stock footage. They might have even drawn it in for all I know. But I never visualized that a saber-toothed tiger would have stripes, because the ones I had seen in history books and things like that, and, you know, science books and stuff, always, you know, basically portrayed a saber-toothed tiger like a mountain lion. So, but I guess probably the only stock footage they could get was maybe from an old jungle film or something like that. So they used real tigers. I kept thinking, boy, that's very strange. Wow. But anyway, I didn't care. It was sort of cool to see this tiger with these big teeth, and it ends up killing a guy who's out hunting. And but it also has been spotted by another hunter who tells this story in the little bar general store. That's up here in the mountain, in the rural part of Northern California, way up in the mountains where a lot of cool monster movies took place, like Giant from the Unknown and the thing that couldn't die and some of the others like that. Yeah, this is a little general store where everyone would hang out. They'd have a beer and all that stuff. Everybody knew each other, you know, because it wasn't a very big area and all that. It was just a very, very small town Americana. And he's telling this story about this thing he saw. Everyone's laughing. Yeah. You just saw a crazy mountain lion, but it couldn't have been what it was. But as it turns out, it gathers the attention of the game warden up there who sees it. He's driving home one night after, you know, patrolling out there because people are complaining about their cattle, their livestock getting massacred, getting slaughtered by some big predator, and they don't know what it is. And as he's driving home, this thing shows up in the middle of the road, jumps on his car, and in a panic, he hits his horn and accidentally turns the radio way up, and it scares it off. So now he's telling these people, hey, this is true. What this guy was saying is true. That there is this big cat and we've got to go find it. Well, he is able to get another guy to go out with him, and they make a plaster cast of a track that they find because they know where the thing was, and it had rained that night, so they knew the ground was sort of wet, and they're able to find a very good track, and they make a cast, and he takes it to the nearby university in Los Angeles. And which is from what we discern probably, you know, a couple hours drive away. And he takes it to a character by the name of Dr. Ross Harkness, played by Richard Crane. Again, all of these people are going to be people that you recognize from TV shows in the 50s and the 60s. Richard Crane had a long career, a lot of Westerns. A lot of these folks were in a lot of Westerns, because if you think about how many Westerns were on in 50s and 60s television, that was a big venue for actors. And of course, he doesn't believe it. He sees this thing. He says, hey, that's a pretty good rendition you made there. But he says, no, this is real. This was from a real track. And he goes, oh, come on. No. That. But he finally convinces him to come up to the mountains and so that he can show him where they found all of this stuff. And again, I'm going to skip over the story quite a bit. But so you've got Dr. Harkness up there. You've got our game warden up there, played by Lee Morgan, Again, another old-time actor. You've got Robert Long, who's another old-time guy. All these guys are, if you saw any kind of Westerns from the 50s or the 60s, you're going to recognize all of these people. And I want to mention that Professor Groves and his daughter also have a housekeeper by the name of Celia, played by Tondra Quinn. Tondra Quinn, you might recognize. She appeared quite a bit on television, always playing a Hispanic type character. And in this, she's a deaf mute who's from Mexico that Professor Groves has taken under his wing and given a job to. And so she's looking after the professor. One other character actor that you're going to see that you absolutely recognize is Robert Easton. Robert Easton was not only known for the various characters that he played on television and movies, but he was considered a dialect genius when it came to English dialects. And he was very much in demand on television and films if they needed someone to teach a rural dialect, a southern dialect, Midwestern dialect, whatever. This guy, Robert Easton, was just incredible. He could sound like anybody. But usually he'd sound like an old country guy and all that. That was the most popular type of character he would play. And you may never know his voice. I mean, may never know his name, but you'll always recognize his voice and him. And he plays one of the townspeople up here by the name of Danny. Anyway, we have all kinds of little characters that pop in and out of the film, including William Fawcett, who we've talked about on several episodes. Old grizzled guy who he plays the town doctor in this. He played in virtually every Western known to man. He was a regular on the old TV show Fury, and also was in, if you were a fan of the old Batman serials, he was in the second Batman serial. He played the bad guy in that one as well. So like I said, a lot of familiar faces. They did a lot of work in these AIP pictures. And this wasn't AIP. This was actually an independent film production company. There's probably one step below AIP. But you're going to see a lot of the people you see in that. One thing you will notice in this movie, too, is the music. The music is going to seem remarkably similar. And if you're a Monster kid, you're going to go, wait a minute, that's the music from War of the Colossal Beast. That's because the music was done by Albert Glasser. Albert Glasser scored more than 200 low-budget films, many for American International Productions. And also, he almost exclusively worked, but he worked with Burt I. Gordon on just about every one of his films. So, if you've seen a Burt I. Gordon film, you've heard the music that Albert has done. And the minute I remember as a kid, when I saw War of the Colossal Beast, I remember thinking, hey, that's Neanderthal Man music and all of that. And so I began sort of following his music. The music's actually pretty good. This was done before War of the Colossal Beast, so Burt I. Gordon used it for his sequel to The Amazing Colossal Man. So again, for Monster Kids, there's a lot of familiarity with this particular film. Anyway, what we find out is going on is that, as I've already told you, Groves turns himself into a Neanderthal man. He gets so upset. We find out he's been injecting cats with this serum that he has perfected to try to create a Neanderthal-type man and turning him into saber-toothed tigers. How one has to do with the other is never explained, and it's a shame because I think if they'd taken a little effort, the writers Aubrey Weisberg and Jack Pollexfen, who owned the production company that did the movie, if they'd taken a little extra time to try to weave a little bit deeper story into this and explain some of this stuff, it might have made for a better movie. It would have helped. It would have helped a great deal because it's like, oh, wait a minute, I think that the theory had to do with man. So, how does the tiger come into this? All this. Anyway, like I said, there's a lot of plot holes all the way throughout here. So now what you've got Groves. He turns into this Neanderthal man because he gives himself the largest dose he's ever given anyone. Of course, we find out he has experimented on one other human being who we're going to tell you about in a minute. And he makes it a point of, unfortunately, he goes out and he kills someone and then ends up back at his cabin. And realizes that The conversion to Neanderthal man took no time at all. And the conversion looks pretty good. You know, it's like the old, like old wolfman, old werewolf type, camera trickery. But it's not bad. It's actually pretty good. And then, but he discovers it takes longer for him to become human again. So he's a little disturbed by that. And plus he's going more and more manic. So he's getting more insane with he's so close to proving his theory. Although the one thing he doesn't seem to realize is that his Neanderthal man that he creates, you know, out of himself becomes like a cold-blooded killer and only concerned with killing. Not exactly the kind of a super intelligent guy that he may have pitched in his theory. At this point now, the storyline relies heavily on Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Obviously, you probably can see that right now. Because now he starts turning into the Neanderthal man at will. He has no control over it. He doesn't have to give himself an injection. We find out that he had been experimenting on Celia, his deaf-mute maid. She doesn't remember it because the one thing is it does sort of create an amnesia-type scenario. But she doesn't totally convert into a Neanderthal woman because as Groves tells us in his narration, it doesn't work entirely with women, but it works fully with men. We don't know why. That would have been something that would have been fun to explore in the script as well. But again, these are low-budget films. I guess they've just got to throw it up there and get the action in there as much as they can. What it all boils down to is that as we've got one other hitch in the storyline that we have to deal with, and that is that Groves is engaged to be married, but the fiance is very, very concerned. The fiance, played by Doris Merrick, she plays Ruth Marshall, has come up to the mountains to find Groves and find out why he has been so secretive and when are they going to get married. And basically, she's going to give him an ultimatum that I can't live like this and all of this. And that is a storyline that sort of gets in the way of everything. As it ends up, as you can probably imagine, the Neanderthal man goes on a tear, and slowly Dr. Harkness and the game warden sort of figure this all out. They sort of figure out, along with the sheriff, that everything is leading back to Groves and that he is the culprit. You know, once they get over the idea that, my God, this thing actually exists, they have manhunts looking for him and all that. They finally corral him. They finally find the Neanderthal man and get him trapped. But not before he has kidnapped Ruth. Of course, he goes off with the girl. And he has already killed Beverly Garland. Poor Beverly, her feature film debut. She gets killed very quickly in this movie. But Ruth manages to get away. After they trap him in a cave with her, and she is able to convince him to run away. So he is intelligent enough to know to get out of there. And while he's trying to run away from the manhunt, he is attacked by yet another saber-toothed tiger that has been created, this time by Dr. Harkness, who has discovered what he's been doing in his lab and injects the poor cat in this film. I felt so sorry for the cat in this film. Who freaks out every time he sees the syringe. So, you know, it has not been pleasant. And we also find out from Groves' narration when he's taking his notes that he's killed a lot of cats in trying to do this. But Harkness accidentally creates another saber-toothed tiger, which ends up attacking Groves as the Neanderthal man and injuring him severely before the manhunt catches up with him and shoots the saber-toothed tiger. And, of course, Groves dies. When they take him back to his cabin and call for the doctor, they can't do anything for him. He cannot recover from his wounds, and he slowly turns back into Groves, the human being, and says it's better this way. We don't know why he thinks it's better this way, but we just have to accept his explanation for that. Like I said, the story jumps all over the place. Which is sort of why I picked the style I did to tell you the story on this episode. Probably a little different than the one I told 4 years ago. But this film is still fun to watch, even as cheesy as it is, and you know, for Robert Chain fans, yes, he really does chew the scenery and overact quite a bit in this, but it's still fun to watch him. He's just such a likable character actor. I think the last time I didn't see him on that episode of The Flash, but I remember seeing him one time in the movie Tora, Tora, Tora. I'd not seen him in many years. And he had become a very successful stockbroker in California after he just sort of got away from acting, and occasionally he would be called back by some directors who remembered him from Adventures of Superman and wanted to put him in their movie. And so he would make these little cameos in movies for the next 20 years or so. But just such a likable guy, and always one of my favorite characters, second only to George Reeves in The Adventures of Superman. It's fun to see him in this. It was fun to see him in Indestructible Man with Lon Chaney Jr. And we may revisit that one again. But for now, this one's for Mom, and it's for the great costumes that she made for me on Halloween on this episode that will be released right around Mother's Day of 2022. And Mom, the memories I have of those costumes and some of the fun we had for Halloween, because Halloween was definitely one of her favorite holidays, like it is with me. Yeah, just great memories that I will always have for the rest of my life, too. Anyway, folks, thanks for indulging me on this episode of Monster Attack. If you want to, go out and check out The Neanderthal Man. You can find it on YouTube. So if you have the YouTube app, you can get, like I said, a pretty good copy of it. And if you're a premier subscriber to YouTube, you can catch it without any commercials or ads in it. Otherwise, it's going to have a few ads thrown in there, but it's not too bad. But it's worth a look just for fun and just have a good time with it. Those were crazy times, and the 50s were just wonderful for watching some really, really wild science fiction movies back then. I don't call it a stinker like the critics did. It has some value. It has some value to me, and I'm sure it has lots of value to other folks out there. It's just a lot of fun. Anyway, folks, thanks so much for indulging me for this episode of Monster Attack. And next week, we have got a very special episode of Monster Attack coming your way. A very special guest host sitting in with me and Mark Maddox. Yes, Mark and I will be working together again on next week's episode with a very special guest. And we're going to be talking about a film that is considered one of the greatest horror films ever made in film history. And I'll just keep you in suspense until we see you next Monday. Have a great week, folks. We'll see you then.
Hey, Martha.
What?
Do you like nerd stuff?
I do.
And do you like adult beverages?
I super do.
Well, then you should join us with a drink.
With a drink.
With a drink. But first, let's talk nerdy.
Clink. On the ESO Network.
We'll see you
on Tuesday.
Maybe next Tuesday.
Maybe.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.